Hello and welcome to the Scooby-Doo Reveal. I'm your host, Zerk, though you may know me as Zerk Monster Hunter 4 on YouTube. With me is my co-host, Pen. Say hello, Pen.
Hello, all of you in digital radio land.
Together, we have decided that every other Wednesday, until we either run out of things to review, or expire, we will review a piece of Scooby-Doo media. For today's episode, we'll be covering the next movie in our run through the What's New era. Chill Out Scooby-Doo, a sort of sequel to Loch Ness Monster. So, without further ado, let's begin our suffering by summarizing the story.
We begin Chill Out Scooby-Doo with some very, very nice snow-themed credits as producers and writers and artists are all... all of their names are emblazoned on flags that go by as we... as our setting is actually established. The Himalayan mountains, specifically Mount Everest and the Sherpa people that live on it. We fade out of the credits to see Professor Jeffries along with Pimba Sherpa searching for some ancient lost city, the city of Shangri-La.
As we catch up with Professor Jeffries and Pimba, we see Professor Jeffries reach sort of this old Himalayan flagstone with the carving of a yeti on it. He then pulls out this ancient scroll with several pictures and then just tears it up after matching the symbols. You know, this 200-year-old scroll, he doesn't need it anymore, he's found the flagstone. Pimba, after seeing this happen and seeing Professor Jeffries consumed by his desire to discover, warns Professor Jeffries that they shouldn't go further up the mountain, to which the professor decides to cut the rope in the middle of a blizzard on the most dangerous mountain in the world, where they literally use bodies of other climbers as landmarks.
Yep.
And just go off alone.
He essentially just kills himself in that sequence.
Yeah.
He does return later, having apparently learned from his own folly, even though even later in the film we see that he definitely doesn't.
So anyways, Pimba, then looking in the snow as the blizzard gets worse for Professor Jeffries, runs into the abominable snowman and is run off the mountain, nearly falls off a cliff, before saving himself with his ice pick at the last moment and pulling himself to safety as he shockingly exclaims that he saw the creature.
And then we do a smash cut to the Scooby Gang in Paris, having another vacation. A vacation from what? We don't know. We also don't know why they have all this money to go to Paris or... Any of the unanswered questions within the Scooby-Doo lore, I guess. An interesting detail is actually that a couple walks by at the beginning of the film, just in like the first establishing shot of the gang. They're a very happy, loving couple, and at the end, they actually have a child. Even though in the first time they're seen, the woman is not visibly pregnant.
No. No. So that means this movie, which appears to take place over the span of about a week, actually apparently took place over the span of about 9 months? I don't know how that worked. But, no. Anyways, as we catch up with the gang, we realize that Scooby and Shaggy are absent, and that Velma has been reading a local French newspaper that details a recent sighting of the abominable snowman on Mount Everest. Daphne, of course, is very apprehensive to jump headfirst into another mystery. She just wants another vacation. Though this changes when they realize that Scooby and Shaggy are nowhere to be found.
They were supposed to be in Paris an hour ago.
As Fred says.
Scooby and Shaggy are on a AC-130 cargo plane heading to Tibet. Because they've been essentially kidnapped by one Alphonse Lafleur. Now, we have several questions about how
this
Scooby
happened.
And Shaggy actually got onto this plane. Because first, why aren't they with the rest of the gang? Because they seem pretty attached, I guess. Second, Alphonse needs them for one specific thing. Alphonse knows that that Scooby and Shaggy are the perfect human bait. So he reckons that he can catch the uncatchable monster, the abominable snowman that's been conquering headlines. So in order to do this, we assume that I guess he just bribes them with food to get in his van or something.
Yeah, no. This just random French Canadian guy straight up kidnaps Scooby and Shaggy.
Yes.
To rope them into his abominable snowman catching plot.
Yep, and that is actually how the conflict of the movie is created, because Scooby and Shaggy get kidnapped by a random French guy.
Yep.
And look, we have discussed over time that Scooby and Shaggy are powerful beings beyond simple humanity.
Well, yes. How did they let this happen? Like, LaFleur has to register on our power scale. Like,
absolutely.
Yeah. Like, if he can stalk Shaggy and Scooby to kidnap them and realize they're live bait with them noticing, he's got to be on the power scale.
Who knows how long LaFleur has been watching them? Even we, scholars of Scooby, do not know.
We do not know. So
maybe one day we will.
So LaFleur literally drops them out of a plane into a crate that hurtles down the mountain in a parachute. At which point, Shaggy gets a call from Fred, and we get one of the better lines in the movies. In the movie, as Fred asks where Shaggy and Scooby even are.
What is that line, Zach?
We're about to go from frequent flyers to frequent criers.
They really should have wrote in frequent dyers, but I have a feeling someone would have had a problem with that.
Yeah. Scooby and Shaggy hurtle down the mountain and crash headfirst into a Tibetan monastery, where they meet the most ominous guy ever since Duncan McGubbin.
A high lama. A man who... Well, do you want to give them the special twist now?
We'll get to that when he reappears in the story.
The important thing to note about the high lama is he has the capabilities to... float off of the ground and close doors with his mind. And yep. He just says really ominous stuff for no reason, because he's like a nice guy later, but he's just really flipping ominous and creepy.
After the High Lama inquires as to why Scooby and Shaggy are there, Pemba, his sister Mingha, and Professor Jeffries all come to see Scooby and Shaggy, who've just crash-landed and made a big noise in the village. Prior to this, we had a bit of an introduction to Mingha, and we realized she has an obsession with the radio station that is run out of the Mount Everest weather station, just up the mountain from the village. Scooby and Shaggy begin conversing with the High Lama, Professor Jeffries, and the siblings, at which point Scooby starts to F around with a gong and ends up in a sacred chamber in the monastery.
As Scooby does, destruction of ancient artifacts and random property damage just kind of comes along with the territory, I guess. Teenagers should really not be allowed to touch anything.
They really shouldn't. Everyone sort of piles up into the sacred chamber, and the High Lama begins to exposit some of the legend of the Yeti, though Professor Jeffries seems a little more concerned with the sacred crystal that is in the shrine that supposedly protects the village from the Yeti's evil influence.
Examine it closer, he says as he looks deep into the weird blue crystal.
Looking like a Dr. Eggman.
I'll get you next time, Hedgehog.
Scooby and Shaggy wonder if they can contact their friends since he's not getting any cell service. And the entire team decides to go up the mountain to the weather station where there is a phone that they can use to call the rest of the gang. Meanwhile, happening with the gang...
Well, what's going on with them is that in the span of what I can only assume is a couple hours, they've gone from Paris to Mongolia.
Yes. Fred geolocated Scooby and Shaggy, drove the mystery machine down, you know, one of the roads Genghis Khan used to invade China.
It's fine, yeah, you don't need travel permits or anything, it's just like, you know, just go with it, really.
What we do get here, though, whilst the gang is traveling through Mongolia is we get a really cute scene where we actually get to see the gang act like normal friends, which is a rare thing, considering most of the time they're just spent solving mysteries and sort of being non-characters and jokesters. So seeing the gang act normal and casual, as Fred and Velma struggle pronouncing the word abominable, is quite funny, and it's cool to see the gang in a more casual sense, and it really builds up their characters and really shows that these characters have a really good legitimate friendship. Though this scene acts as a small bit of exposition as well to basically get the rest of the gang and the audience caught up onto what exactly is going on in the Himalayas.
Yep, because Velma, Wikipedia as she is, the free encyclopedia that anyone can edit, just kind of exposits the legend of the Yeti to the rest of the gang, as she tends to do because she is an exposition machine.
Thanks, Velma. So, Scooby and Shaggy are going up the mountain with Pemba, Professor Jeffries, oh, and Mr. LaFleur, of course, who showed up as well.
Who has been following Shaggy and Scooby, for he knows that wherever they go, the monster will follow.
Yes, in his own words. Mr. LaFleur spots that Minga, Pemba's sister, has been following them. When she gets up, she warns them that there has been a storm forecast by the weather station. Of course, Pemba uses this moment to chastise his sister and call her out for obviously having a crush on the weatherman.
Who does have quite a silky smooth voice.
I would
like to also say that when Mingha comes up to the group to say that there is this big storm coming, that a cloud of ominous fog begins to roll in over the Himalayas. And I choose to believe that this is our previous most ominous candidate coming to challenge the High Lama for head...
Like an ominous battle. They just stare at each other intently while weird fog and strange wind blows their clothes in odd directions.
Do you think they would just, like, stare at each other for hours?
Yeah, whoever flinches first loses.
That's pretty good.
The storm rolls in, and they decide to make camp for the night, but not before Shaggy and Scooby realize that mountain climbing requires a lot of eating. And they also stumble upon Professor Jeffrey's sled, which is full of dynamite.
The eating thing you just said is because they remark to our friend Alphonse that they are very hungry and they could really go for a warm Scooby snack right now, which Alphonse takes to mean that he just has an entire sealed crate full of them because he has planned this out and he knows them personally.
Too well.
Too well.
Too well. They camp in for the night and Professor Jeffrey sneaks off. Being all creepy and stuff. It is from here that Scooby and Shaggy begin to go out on first watch, hoping not to get caught by the abominable snowman, at which point Mr. LaFleur shows that he has trapped the entire camp.
It's quite sophisticated traps, too. Truly, LaFleur and Fred would have a great and long-lasting friendship.
This, of course, leads us into the first chase. But there's enough chases in this movie that we'll give them all their own section. But chase one occurs, LaFleur ends up getting separated, and the whole group gets split up. Pemba gets trapped in one of LaFleur's traps, LaFleur gets separated from Scooby and Shaggy, and the chase ends after the abominable snowman rampages through the camp, with Scooby and Shaggy getting picked up by a massive snow cat. And inside is a character from Loch Ness Monster who we were all too familiar with.
El goddamn Chillman.
Yes, Del is back, and he is the mysterious weatherman, as it was.
Once again, voiced by Johnny Bravo, well, the voice of Johnny Bravo, who also voiced a pilot, the pilot of Alphonse's ill-fated flight earlier in the film. He really does have some good pipes on him.
Not for real, though. Excellent guy. Ooh. A lot of range. Del takes Scooby and Shaggy back in the snowcat to the weather station. He offers them hot chocolate, and they catch up with Del, realizing that their Nessie expedition didn't really yield any results. Nessie was a no-show, in Del's words.
Since Nessie is a no-show, he has dedicated his life, once again, to finding the Yeti. He is also the only scientist at a weather station on Mount Everest, which seems very peculiar, actually. There is also one question I would like to pose to you, Zach, the aforementioned superfan of the Hex Girls. And that is, does Del Chillman like the Hex Girls?
The thing is, most of what Del has been shown listening to is it's a lot of soft rock style stuff. Like the song he was listening to all across Loch Ness Monster. And actually, if you can... You can hear that same song muffled in Minga's earphones when she's first listening to the radio in her introduction scene. So a little bit of foreshadowing for really eagle-eared viewers. I don't know. Del seems like way more of a soft rock kind of guy. The Hex Girls are basically a gender-bent Green Day. They're super pop punk. So I don't know if that's really Del's vibe.
I mean, I can see it. The man is high 24/7. I don't even know where he gets it on, you know, Mount Everest, but
he actually seems a little more in it this in this movie compared to Loch Ness Monster. Like, he doesn't seem stoned as bad. So maybe he's rationing it. That's why he's got to leave. That's why he's got to leave the mountain. He needs more weed.
Since the rest of the Scooby Gang have actually found themselves at the Sherpa Village, they go up to the camp left by Pemba, Alphonse, the professor, and Scoob and Shag, of course, to find Pemba, who is somehow not dead after having survived the night in a cold metal cage in his bed clothes on Mount Everest. Power move, I guess. I feel like, you know, he might be one of those super, like, he doesn't register on the power scale, but he might be one of those superhumans who could just, like, take it real easy.
Yeah, like that weird Dutch guy who was on the one episode of Goop Lab.
Exactly. Just because they're special and their body is weird and strange. So once they find that, once they find Pemba, they head up to the weather station, where Scooby and Shaggy have been attacked by the abominable snowman.
Yes. Now, I want to mention before this, they realize that Scooby and Shaggy are up there because they find Minga's radio in the snow. And this leads the gang to basically conclude that Minga was kidnapped by the abominable snowman since she's nowhere to be seen once they comb through the camp. It is then at this point, yes, Scooby and Shaggy are attacked by the Abominable Snowman, and we get our second chase as the Abominable Snowman ransacks the radio station trying to get at Scoob and Shag. They are able to escape by hopping a ride on the weather balloon and cutting the cord to start floating across the mountain range.
We also manage to lose Alphonse after he shows up in a surprise to save Scoob and Shag from the Abominable Snowman. However, he miscalculates just a tiny bit, and his ice pick, which he placed to in order to not fall off a cliff, actually just causes the cliff to collapse beneath him, making Alphonse fall into the mist below. He was also holding a gun at this point, a very cartoonish gun with a very wide barrel, because, of course, it is a children's movie. They can't have guns in these. Yes. That would be silly.
Yes. So, with Alphonse gone, Scoob and Shag realize that their air balloon is running out of fuel. And, since they're getting higher with no sense of how to get down, they pop it. And end up falling into a chasm and landing in deep snow amongst a massive Buddhist shrine. At which point, Scooby and Shaggy literally discover the lost kingdom of Shangri-La. This is just a thing that happens in this movie. They just find that. Shangri-La, interestingly, is not an actual thing in Buddhist mythology. It's actually a interpretation of the actual Tibetan Buddhist kingdom of Shambhala, which is the kingdom to be ruled by the next Buddha, according to Tibetan mythology. Shangri-La itself was popularized by British pulp stories of people who came back from the British Expeditionary Force following their occupation of India in the 1930s and 40s. And it basically became this El Dorado-style mythos, even though, unlike El Dorado, there is actually a large basis, again, in the actual Tibetan equivalent of Shambhala. So if we're going off of that, that means that Scooby and Shaggy literally stumbled onto a sacred kingdom where the Buddha, the future Buddha, is supposed to rule.
Yep.
It is here that they meet a much younger, much spryer High Lama with a different staff. So
an ex- explains to them that they are, in fact, in Shangri-La. Mm-hmm. And Zach, I believe you had something to say about our friend the High Lama.
So, if the High Lama can float, close doors with his mind, seemingly teleport between this hidden kingdom that is based on a kingdom where the future Buddha is to rule, that means that Shaggy and Scooby, like, low-key met the Buddha, is what I'm gathering from both my research and what happens in this movie.
Fair viewers, you will note that this will not be the last time that Shaggy and Scooby visit mythological creatures and gain their power.
So it is, I believe it is our headcanon, Pen, that this is the beginning of Scooby and Shaggy's path to enlightenment and unlocking their like ultimate ultra instinct.
Their true power.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, so they low-key meet the Buddha and kind of just parade around Shangri-La, messing with the local monkeys. Before Shaggy and Scooby are ready to go to sleep in Shangri-La, now that they feel that they're safe from the Yeti, only to run into the Yeti.
However, we have to talk about the gang first. Having met Del, finally, after he shows up to help them out with Pemba, and they all go to the weather station together to find some helium tanks missing. So they find out that these helium tanks are missing. They also... A seismograph located within the weather station also says that strange readings are coming from inside of the mountain, as if somebody were, to say, blowing it up. Mm-hmm. They decide to investigate.
By going through the caves. Meanwhile, Daphne and Pemba, looking for the Yeti, trip over an empty helium tank in the ice caves of Mount Everest. This leads them to believe that the abominable snowman might be more man than snow. Daphne and Pemba continue deeper into the caves. Velma, Fred, and Del also continue into the caves, and Shaggy and Scooby run through the Yeti through the underground catacombs of Shangri-La. Eventually, at a fork in the road near a minecart track, all of the gang converges on one spot, and we engage in our third chase after the gang all meets up.
Professor Jeffries, the anime villain that he is, has been using the TNT on his cart to blow chunks of crystals off of the wall. We never actually get an explanation of, like, what these crystals are or if they're even valuable. No, he's just evil and he wants them. He just really wants the big crystal.
He'll get those Chaos Emeralds.
He will get those Chaos Emeralds one day. Perhaps this is Eggman before he became an egg, Mr. Kintobor. He is also evil and British, so, you know, keep that as it may. The British truly are the most evil beings on this planet.
They catch Professor Jeffries in one of Fred's famous traps and believe him to be the one creating the abominable snowman to try and scare everyone away so he can steal the lost treasure of Shangri-La. This is immediately proven false, however, as the abominable snowman attacks everybody and we get a minecart section. So at the end of this, everybody is sort of tossed out of the ice cave at different intervals, first of which are Del, Pemba, Fred, and the girls. They then build a massive snow ramp in the Tibetan village and stretch a net over the courtyard of the monastery so that they can launch the abominable snowman in there and hopefully catch it and find out who it really is. Meanwhile, Professor Jeffries, tangling with the abominable snowman trying to get the crystal out of the mines, encounters Scoob and Shag. Scoob and Shag end up on his TNT cart. They end up blowing it up, and all four of them begin hurtling down the mountain at the same time. Scooby and Shaggy begin epically snowboarding while Professor Jeffries continues to fight with the monster. As Scooby and Shaggy eventually get down the mountain, they end up triggering Fred's trap inadvertently and getting stuck in it, only for Professor Jeffries to cut the rope that the abominable snowman is trailing behind him on and then hurtle into the trap himself, leaving the abominable snowman alone as an avalanche caused by the explosion from Professor Jeffries' cart begins hurtling down the side of the mountain towards the village, leaving Del and Velma vulnerable in the snowcat.
Well, what you don't expect from a Scooby-Doo monster decides, instead of running away to safety, to actually jump towards the snowcat to save both Del and Velma. Now, if you were paying attention pretty much at all during the events of the movie, I'm pretty sure you know who the monster is. Mingha Sherpa. So, it is worth noting that Sherpa, as the last name noted for these characters in this movie, is in fact correct, as the Sherpa people are, they only have the single first name. Sherpa is what they put on census forms. Just a small actual historical tidbit, little fact there.
With Ming-Ha revealed, she basically explains her motivation for creating the Abominable Snowman hoax. As it turns out, it's literally the same motivation that Pembroke had in Loch Ness Monster. So this movie is a sequel through and through. She literally just wanted to fuck Del.
Yep, that's it. And she actually has ruined all the chances that Del had of staying on Mount Everest because she wrecks the weather station. Also, Ming-Ha, in this continuity, actually invents power armor, because she invents the Yeti suit is lighter than a regular person, yet can punch through steel and concrete. Ming-Ha is somehow, as just some random person on the fucking Tibetan countryside, a better scientist than a lot of people. However, to things like the Taggart brothers, who are just two really muscly dudes with a tarp and a bunch of wood, and they animate a monster just through their swollenness alone, Ming-Ha does this as like a 5'9 woman. I don't know how she does it. I don't think I want to know how she does it.
But Del is into it. So, yes. In a way, it all works out for her. Professor Jeffries is, I guess, arrested for malpractice archaeology? I don't know.
I don't really know. I don't know what the jurisdiction of that is, because if I'm going to be honest, who owns Shangri-La? It's a lost city, right? But he does cause a lot of property damage with the avalanche. That was his fault, I guess. It's very weird, because, you know, did Professor Jeffries actually do anything wrong?
I mean, he didn't report his find, and he's the whole movie, he's basically Belloc from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I guess he also does wield a pickaxe with intent, so,
yeah.
I mean,
he threatens Scooby and Shaggy's life with a pickaxe.
Yeah, he does. Oh, boy.
The movie ends with everyone, including Ming-Ha and Del, going back to Paris, only to find that Fred got on the wrong plane and ended up in the Amazon. So everybody piles into the van, you know, to get across the Atlantic Ocean.
It's gonna take a really, really slow ferry. It's gonna be a couple weeks, my dude. We're just gonna take a cruise. It'll be fine.
And you know, go rescue Fred, and that's,
yes,
that's where
it is. Also
ends.
Worth noting that Alphonse is not dead.
Yep, he was
having been saved by an actual Yeti.
So they do the same thing like they did in Loch Ness Monster, where they imply that there was actually a real monster out there in addition to the hoax. Yeah.
Which is it is really a sequel through and through.
So the supporting cast in this movie, I think this is a really good one. Like,
oh yeah, no, I agree.
Professor Jeffries is kind of a forgettable villain.
He really is anime as heck, though. Like,
yeah, no, seriously. For real, though. He literally has, like, the freaking glasses shine, and, like, he's about to bring down the axe. Like,
he's so evil for no reason. His actual reasoning for this is he hates his job, so he just wants to, like, relax in the sun by the beach. So he's going to steal this ancient crystal. You know, I feel like finding Shangri-La would give you everything you would want, because, you know, you would have international fame for finding flipping Shangri-La and the Buddha. I mean, for God's sakes, Shangri-La is said by the High Lama to give essentially indefinite life to whoever lives there permanently. This man could just live there forever. They found immortality. You could just sell that. But no, you need the quartz crystals they keep in the weird minecart basement.
I will say, though, Professor Jeffries is the twist villain of It Was Man the whole time. Works way better than McIntyre did in Loch Ness Monster, simply because Professor Jeffries is a character that has been kind of sketchy since the beginning, and he's also, we see him throughout the movie, so we actually get to know his motivations and who he is as a character. We actually get to spend time with him. So when he turns evil, it's not a twist. And what is actually a twist in the movie is that despite him being the villain of the movie, he's not the one perpetrating the hoax. So it's a really interesting subversion of the Scooby-Doo formula in that way. And I think it works way better than that compared to what they tried to do a very similar thing in Loch Ness Monster, but they just didn't have the setup and payoff to pull it off. And I'm really glad that they tried it again, because conceptually they were on the right track, and I think they pull it off much better in this movie.
Absolutely. Setups and payoffs, that's where it's all at.
Yeah.
That's where all the good story writing is.
I think we talked enough about the High Llama, so let's move on to the Sherpa siblings.
Absolutely. So Pemba, what does Pemba actually do in this movie?
He gets mad at the Abominable Snowman. He's also part of the inciting incident, because Pemba's sighting on the mountain, which, depending on how you read it, might be actually the real Abominable Snowman and not his sister.
They actually do show his picture on the newspaper that Velma is reading in France.
Yeah. And it's I'm also assuming that his sighting was also the catalyst for Lafleur springing his plan. So Pemba's sighting is largely sort of the inciting incident for a lot of this movie.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Pemba's he's a very interesting character, because he's a very driven dude. He's clearly the most down to earth and most serious character.
Yes.
But his dynamic with his sister is really good, because he really does feel like an older sibling to her.
Yeah, just wants the best for his sister, but his sister is a little bit of an airhead and also apparently a scientific genius.
Yeah.
Which,
speaking of Mingha.
Okay, so Mingha. Mingha's plan makes no sense whatsoever. Her entire thing is, I want to dress up as the Abominable Snowman so that Del will have a reason to stay on the mountain. Now, first of all, they say that she doesn't actually know who the radio host is at the beginning. However,
she's been up there.
Yes, she has been up there, because she's stolen the helium tanks. So, which one is it, movie? Does she know him, or does she not know him? Because they never address him by name until he actually shows up. They do not say Del Chilman, the radio host. They simply say the radio host at the weather station. I assume that this is so that they can have, you know, the surprise, oh, here's a character from the previous movie. But it doesn't make any flipping sense. Also, as we've stated before, this Yeti outfit is lighter than air. And in fact, at the finale, she uses the helium tanks to float the entire Yeti suit along with the weight of Del and Velma to escape the avalanche. I don't understand how she made a suit that can carry two adult human beings without crushing underneath its weight, but it's also lighter than air.
If the U.S. military gave Mingha money to produce these, there would, like, once again, we have proven that Scooby-Doo is actually sci-fi for this exact reason.
Yep. Yeah, never mind Professor Pembroke making a crazy homemade submarine that's a perfect facsimile of a plesiosaur.
Yeah, it's fine.
Mingha Sherpa just low-key created power armor.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's power armor. It's fine. The kids will get that. The kids, they'll get it.
They'll get it.
And then there's Jacques Lafleur, our last character.
Oh, sorry, Alphonse Lafleur. I'm having one of those with him. I'm having one of those Berenstain Bears moment where I always thought his name was Jacques, but when we rewatched this movie, his name's Alphonse. I'm like, I always thought it was Jacques. Like,
It sounds right, though. It really does.
Like,
he's Jacques Lafleur, but Alphonse Lafleur. Alphonse doesn't roll off the tongue quite as much.
Yeah, but Jacques Lafleur. Yeah, yeah.
Jacques Lafleur.
So I think we'll just call him Lafleur. Yeah.
Yes, Lafleur. So Lafleur registers on our power scale, as does Mingha, because apparently she's a scientific fucking genius. Oh, also the Dalai, the High Lama.
Well, the High Lama might low-key be the Buddha.
Yes, that means he definitely registers in our power scale. Lafleur is a strange character in this movie, as he just wants to hunt and trap the abominable snowman. But that's not really why he's on the power scale. He's on the power scale because he has spent months stalking Scooby and Shaggy to find the perfect human bait. That is why. It is because even with Scoob and Shag's weird powers, they cannot detect this man. I could just imagine the sweaty Frenchman with binoculars in his eyes, in an unmarked white van, like looking through their window on the weekend, just watching them run and saying, "Yes, yes, these will do nicely. Yes."
No, for real though. Lafleur is just he's hilarious, honestly. Like, not only is his accent ridiculous, and I think he's actually voiced by a French Canadian, so like they actually got someone who speaks French, so his accent is done for some like excellent bits of comedy, and he sprinkles in a ton of French words in there, so he actually sounds like a French guy. And he is a riot throughout the film. Like, especially during and I think since that's all the side characters, we can talk about chase one.
So I think we should just outline what actually happens in this chase.
The abominable snowman sort of descends on the camp during this chase, and Scooby and Shaggy run through the laser grid that Alphonse set up, which triggers every single one of the trap. And since Shaggy and Scooby are so fast, they escape all of them, leaving Lafleur to get hit by everything whilst they get chased by the abominable snowman around.
He takes at least 5 bear traps, a net, and 4 tranquilizer missiles.
That don't tranquilize him. This man has the constitution of a god.
Oh man, his butt must really hurt though.
No, for real.
Or maybe he just can't feel it, I don't know.
I don't know.
So, the music in this chase is one of the highlights, as it is one of the 2 tracks composed by our good friend Tom Chase, who is actually credited in most of the direct-to-TV movies as Thomas Chase Jones. The only reason I can think of being that he can't actually use the name Tom Jones, because, you know, the much more famous one. So, I'm going to start calling him Tom Jones, because most of the time his work is fantastic. Mm-hmm. So, Tom Jones does a really great job composing the music for this chase and another. However, the first music in this chase, really, really good. Really, really good. But about halfway through the chase, it changes from sort of a rock to a country thing.
Yeah,
and it's not good.
Yeah, no, there are 2 moments where the track breaks to accommodate one of sort of the Bugs Bunny style, dress up like something else to screw with the villain, Scooby and Shaggy gags. Because they do 2 of them in this chase. They first dress up as Santa and a reindeer to mess with the monster. And then they also dress up as like Inuit ice fishermen to mess with the monster. And during the ice fisherman gag, it turns into country, which totally kills the vibe. And likewise, there's like a Jingle Bells rendition for when they do the North Pole gag. And it just kind of ruins the vibe of you have this really, really nice grunge rock sort of song going on with a very Australian vocalist that I was really jamming to, but it kind of, like, despite how decent the jokes are, it does kill the boppage level to the song, which I think brings down the chase a little.
Yeah, absolutely. So we both rated that a 7 out of 10?
Yes. Overall, it's not as strong as the first chase in Loch Ness Monster, but it's a good first start for Scooby-Doo. Definitely the first half of the chase, where you get to really listen to that grunge rock song, is definitely the highlight of this chase.
Oh, yeah. I don't think anything. I honestly, that first chase in Loch Ness is so good that it's really, really hard to top.
Yeah, no, Loch Ness has probably, like, overall much better chases than this movie, and think it's going to be probably our gold standard of chases for the most part going forward.
Yeah, definitely.
Now I remember Legend of the Vampire and Where's My Mummy having really good chases in them as well. So it's going to be interesting to see how those compare when we get to those. But overall, the first chill out chase is pretty strong. That moves us into the second chill out chase, which right before the chase, one of the best gags in the movie, Shaggy delivering help as a bulletin, like Scooby with the soundboard, whilst the monster is just in the background and Shaggy doesn't notice it. Oh, it's just, it is like a four-hit combo of just excellent visual and auditory humor.
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful. So as for context for the listeners out there who may or may not have seen the film, by the way, go watch it before you listen to these. So the abominable snowman starts pounding on the windows of the weather station, which, you know, repurposed into a radio station, and Shaggy is handed a piece of paper that has help kind of badly scrawled on it by Scoob. He then relays that information into the radio for no reason. And it's just wonderful. It's just a wonderful gag. I really, really enjoy it.
Yeah. And this movie,
in fact, this chase, I think, has really good gags in it.
Oh yeah. This chase, there's the boxing gag in here, as well as a couple other gags with snowmen. And the gags in this chase are really top tier. The only thing really that kind of bogs down this chase is the track for this chase is just instrumental.
Yeah.
Like there's no lyrics to really bop or vibe to. So mm-hmm. you're really going off of just this one guitar riff that's kind of noodling throughout the chase. So
yeah.
you really have to rely on the strength of the gags here. And while the gags are really strong, I think the fact that the music doesn't pump up the chase to the levels of what it could be, I think do bring it down. So we both gave the second chase a 6.5 out of 10.
Absolutely.
And that moves us to the third chase, with all the gang together for this massive minecart section, Indiana Jones Temple of Doom style.
Very good.
Very excellent chase. Everybody just ends up in Shangri-La, and the music here just bops super hard. It's that same sort of grunge rock sound you get in the first chase, but it plays throughout the entire chase this time.
It's really quite good. They have a good hallway gag with
There's a hallway gag homage in here where there's three minecarts, Jeffrey's sled, Scooby and Shaggy's minecart, and then Del, Fred and the girls' minecart, and the monster Jeffrey's and Scoob and Shag and Fred and the girls all kind of switch spots in an homage to the hallway gag, and it's just an excellent piece of classic Scooby-Doo visual humor. Yeah.
And I gave that a 7.5 because I personally like the music, but I think the gags could have used just a little bit more work.
Yeah. Yeah, no, Penn. I agree with you. The gags are a little dry, but I really like the set piece of the whole thing. And to me, the fact that this is a Scooby-Doo chase on a minecart section, that's just not something you really see often. Like, the only other movie I can think of with, like, a minecart chase is Temple of Doom. Just the sheer originality of the set piece, like, I mean, unless you play Donkey Kong Country, I guess, but the originality of the set piece, I think, really elevates the chase for me, so I gave that one an 8 out of 10.
Absolutely. And that brings us to the finale.
Yes.
Actually.
So, again, as we discussed earlier, Professor Jeffries is a much better twist, the real enemy was man, antagonist, than McIntyre was in Loch Ness. And this whole finale, like, the final trap isn't complicated, but the set piece of Scooby and Shaggy doing an epic Tony Hawk snowboard down the mountain with an avalanche following them is just so freaking cool, dude.
Yeah, it's great. Sickest jump of all time. Not really. I'm pretty sure they actually do sicker jumps later on in Scooby-Doo canon.
Yeah. Phantasaur, I think, has some pretty sick bike jumps.
Yeah, man. Oh, I can't wait for Phantasaur.
Yeah.
We will get to it eventually.
Yeah. So this whole finale with the avalanche kind of adding a wrinkle and putting everyone in danger, I think it's just a really good finale in that you have this really unique set piece going on, and it really uses the setting to its advantage.
Like, yeah, I would agree.
Like, compared to Loch Ness, they're all on boats because it's a lake. Whereas here, yeah, they're on a mountain and they have like skiing and snowboarding and the snow cat and the Yeti, and it's just cool.
Oh, it's just great. This is quite a good finale, I would say. I think we both gave it an 8 out of 10.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, no, definitely. Because the Loch Ness one we gave a 6, so this is a huge step up.
This is very much a higher quality ending than Loch Ness was, because Loch Ness kind of just petered out. There really wasn't even a trap in Loch Ness. It all just kind of chaos and explosions and stuff.
Yeah. Whereas this one, the trap actually kind of worked because it did catch the real villain in Professor Jeffries. It's just a really cool set piece. So overall, really good finale to wrap up Chill Out Scooby-Doo as a whole. So, Penn, with having discussed the finale, do you have any other closing thoughts on Chill Out Scooby-Doo just overall, and we'll give our overall rating?
I don't think I do. To be honest, this one I just thoroughly enjoyed as someone who enjoys Scooby-Doo. This is just quite a good Scooby-Doo movie. It's quite good.
Yeah.
I give it an 8 out of 10.
Yeah.
Just across the board as the movie. It's pretty good.
I'm right up with you there. This was one I had on DVD as a kid, so I got a lot of fond memories of this one. And the thing about it is, like, as far as What's New movies go, it's like the What's New movies, I think, are the biggest grab bag of quality in terms of whether they're good or not. Like,
yeah, you'll see us tear apart the Goblin King later.
Yes. Yeah, no, I'm not looking forward to that. They're kind of a grab bag of quality, but this one is very much on the high end. Like, we said Loch Ness Monster was on the top half of these.
Yeah.
Whereas I think this one is towards among the best of the What's New era Scooby-Doo movies. And
absolutely.
Like, there's not really anything special or super remarkable about Chill Out. It's just, it is a very tight, very perfectly distilled Scooby-Doo story. And, like, as far, like, our ratings out of 10... Obviously, 10 isn't like Casablanca quality. We're talking about like 10 as in the platonic ideal of Scooby-Doo here.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think and this movie really does like hit a lot of the marks of what you want in a Scooby-Doo movie. So I gave this one an 8 out of 10 as well. And that's a very strong 8. Like, I could go higher, but I might be giving the movie a little too much credit because the story is ultimately a little generic. Like, Scooby-Doo has done Scooby-Doo's done Yetis before and since, like the Snow Ghost in the classic series. So there's a little bit of an originality there, but the fact that it's just told so well, I think, is towards the movie's favor, which is why I gave it about an 8 out of 10. And I think that will wrap up my thoughts for it.
Absolutely. And now, since this is the second episode of the program, I would like to introduce a small little just end segment thing. This is our scorecard. So, for this movie, we have a 7.4 average for our chases, meaning that it's pretty good. It's an 8 out of 10 for both of us for the whole movie. We still haven't seen anything of Scrappy-Doo, thank God. We also haven't heard from Tom Kenny. Also, thank God. Once again, I do not hate Tom Kenny. I harbor no misfortune towards him. I simply see him in everything, and I wish to tally his
his appearances.
His appearances in Scooby-Doo. We also come out to a actually reasonably restrained amount of ice puns in this movie at 4.
Yes.
There are only 4 ice puns. We may have missed one or two, but that is actually reasonably restrained for a Scooby-Doo movie, considering they are mostly made out of puns.
Yes.
And that's the episode. Thanks for listening, and remember, we wouldn't have a podcast without those meddling kids and their dog.